Hey everybody, it's Rajesh here.
And Tane here.
Welcome to our podcast, Baskets of Knowledge, Chats with a Difference. In our podcast, we invite guests from around the country and around the world to talk about how they got to where they are at the moment. It's about a journey. It's about an experience. It's about their life.
Kerakot, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Baskets of Knowledge. This is episode 114, I think. But hey, it could be episode one for you, depending when you are listening to it. Thank you for joining us today. Tane, how have you been filling your basket of knowledge?
Yeah, I think something I've recognised over the last week or so, now that we've started getting into the rugby season for women's rugby and starting to get into some of my other coaching roles as well, I guess just realising and recognising that you don't always have to be the main person, you know, coaching or being heavily involved. You can just go and support. Last night I went down to watch one of the Premier games and, you know, got to support a few of the girls that I've coached in other spaces, which was quite special. And, you know, just by showing that support, I think they still recognize you can have an impact in those spaces, you know, without having the title of head coach or, you know, head trainer or whatever it might be in that capacity. And I think also it just solidifies those relationships too, you know, even within the competition that I'm in the women's development grade, seeing some of the other players play for the other teams and, you know, getting to chat with them afterwards and seeing what they're doing in their other spaces. It just goes to show that, yeah, again, you don't always have to be front and center in everything you do. You can take a step back and still have such a big impact in, you know, what you are trying to achieve. And I guess, you know, like going to these spaces, that's not what I'm setting out to achieve. I just want to go and enjoy watching some footy. But, you know, these are the, I guess, flow on effects of, you know, showing up and being present.
I think that's the big thing. You know, when you go and do something, you go there because you want to go, not because you have to go. You go there because you want to do something, not for the recognition or the titles or whatever. You go, right, and all the other stuff happens the way the universe works, which is pretty, it's pretty cool, because you're learning from this week links up to my learning this week as well, which as a quote I read the other day, which is basically 90% of life is showing up. And when you show up, something will happen, right? You know, lots of times we choose not to show up to things because of whatever reason, and then nothing happens. But when you start showing up for things, we're not saying it's going to be a good thing or a bad thing. Something happens whenever you go somewhere. Something will happen. You might meet a new person. You might go, this is not my jam. But if you don't ever show up, nothing ever happens. So which links really cool back to what you've just said before. You know, you just showed up yesterday for the game. No agenda. Just wanted to watch the young Wahina doing their thing. And things happen. So, you know, and I think the more I reflect about that, is the more I think about how many opportunities we don't take because we don't even bother showing up. And, you know, I think that's been a theme of our guests over the last, you know, year or so, that they've all showed up, whether it's putting an application in or whether it's chatting to somebody. So, you know, that's a learning for me. And I think it's a learning that I think we should try and embrace, that, you know, when you think about what's stopping you, question that reason. Is it because you are afraid, or What is that reason? That 10%, what is it? So but hey, that's us. We can keep bantering forever, as our regular listeners know. If you want to do that, listen to one of our episodes where it's just the two of us and you can hear our voices for an hour. Happy days. But we're not here for that there. As you know, we scour the country and scour the world to find people that we think we are interesting and amazing. And as we always say, we think everyone is amazing, everyone is interesting, everyone's got a story to tell. And we obviously can't interview everybody, because people run away from us, but that's cool. But also, we just, yeah, we'd love to do that there. Today's guest is someone that I think both Tane and myself think is a fantastic human being. We both had the privilege of working with them in different roles. I personally have watched from afar as they have done what they've done, and it's been pretty cool. And Tane, I guess you've worked with our guests, which is gives a whole different insight. So we're pretty honored and privileged to have on our podcast today, Selma. Welcome to Baskets of Knowledge.
Well, thank you for having me. It's such a privilege. Thank you.
I think the privilege is ours. So thank you so much, especially in your busy, busy time. Selma, for our listeners who don't know anything about you, do you want to let them know who you are and what you're doing at this moment?
Yeah, of course. So, kia ora koutou, assalamu alaikum. My name is Selma. Born in Jordan, moved to New Zealand when I was two, but originally, whenever I get the question, where are you from, I always answer from Sudan, which is where my bloodline leads me to. I recently graduated from Otago Uni in December with a Bachelor's of Pharmacy. I do notice you have quite a few of my cohort on your podcast. And currently, right now, I'm back home in Palmy North, completing my internship in pharmacy in community pharmacy. So that's where I'm currently at the moment.
Awesome, man. You know, wherever you're at the moment is you've got a story to get to where you are. And, you know, I'm just going to go straight into it because your intro already has got lots of awesome questions. So born in Jordan, moved to New Zealand, but bloodline from Sudan. What is that like for you? And I asked that question because I have people always asking the same question is where you're from. And I'm like, oh, this is an interesting question. How do I answer this question here? So obviously for you, there's lots of deep layers there. And yeah, let's explore that avenue there. So let's talk about growing up. Your Sudanese heritage and then moving into New Zealand. You know, what is your family story in that, I guess?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking. That question, where you're from, is not an easy one to answer, I feel. Because what exactly do you mean where I'm from? Depending on what you're asking, my answer will be different. Being my journey or my family's journey coming here to Aotearoa, New Zealand, is I think can a lot of people who have immigrated to this country might be able to relate as well. My dad, he left Sudan in the 90s because he could just see politically the direction that the country was going in was not very good. And he left at a good time. He left at a good time and he ventured off to Turkey, did some traveling, and he came across someone there who offered him a job to work in a farm. So my dad, he's a vet. He graduated with his doctorate in vet in Sudan. So started his life in Jordan, married my mum, had me there, and I was there for about a year until we moved off to Oman, and we were there for another year, and then we came to New Zealand. My dad, I guess, pushed factors for him coming to or leaving the Middle East to come to here was just like some visas, immigrant sort of issues related. So he really did have to find a different place to settle in. And he had lots of different places to choose from, but New Zealand just appealed to him in so many different ways. And he was thinking about his family and my, you know, future children if they were to have, and I've got two younger brothers as well who were born here, and providing opportunities for us, especially knowing how difficult it is at home. So my parents, ever since from a very young age, have instilled in us that we are Sudanese first and foremost, as much as we are Kiwis as well. My brothers, they were born here, so they've got that automatic isn't as Kiwis, but I guess for us trying to come from a different place and somewhere which was so foreign and trying to find our feet, and you know, everything here is so different, the language, the social customs, trying to fit in but also not forgetting where you're coming from and your heritage is also quite a huge struggle as well. So I guess Jordan, I still do identify with my birthplace, but not much more than that. But with my heritage being from Sudan, I think that I hold that really close to me, while also my identity being a Kiwi, because I don't, let's put that apart as well, because that's also really important. That's part of me as well. Yeah.
And thank you for sharing that, because it's like such a layered question, you know, and it's a layered in not in a bad way, just because, you know, immigrants, I'm an immigrant, you're an immigrant, and Tana, you have your own story being Maori as well. You know, we all have our stories, which we will say, where are you from, who do you fuck up back to? I'm like, oh, exactly like you. I mean, I live in New Zealand. It's given me a lot in my life. You know, there's so many advantages of living in New Zealand. But I was born and raised in Zimbabwe, and I'm like, okay, cool, that's a big part of my life. But I'm also ethnically Indian, which is also another part of my life. So, you know, very similar to your strand, your ethnic or your birth, your bloodline links back to a place where you weren't born, but now you live in a place where you weren't born or you weren't raised. It's so layered, but it's really cool. And I think the advantage for us is that we get to embrace all of those cultures, but at the same time, how do we navigate that in a world that is so crazy diverse, and where people base their judgments initially on what you look like straight away? You know, that's the first impression, and then that dictates a storyline for them. So it's really awesome. Thank you for sharing that there. But a question I have for you is, Oman, Jordan, Sudan, Turkey, all crazy, super multicultural, you know, in terms of the kinds of people that are there. How was the North? What is that like for your family? I mean, obviously you are young. For those of you that don't live in New Zealand, Palmerston North is a tiny, oh, I'm going to say tiny, is a small city in in between Wellington and New Plymouth and Wanganui. I don't know how to say it, but yeah, what is that like for you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You can imagine when we moved here in the early 2000s, the ethnic demographic. So Palmerston North now, I would say, is very ethnically diverse. We've grown a lot for a small or a big town, small city. We actually do have a lot of like different cultures and ethnicities and a lot of diversity in the small place. But in the early 2000s, that was not the case. We were one of very few in the city. And that was a huge struggle. That was tough. And I found like the community, the Muslim community, the Arab community, the African community, we really had to stick together because, like, you know, who else would be able to understand us and, you know, our struggles of also trying to navigate ourselves through this different country while also not losing ourselves and our, you know, our background at the same time. So I won't lie to you, it was tough. If I were to think back to, I don't remember this, and thank goodness I don't. I was too young to remember. My parents, they first tried to get me to go to kindergarten that was close to us, because all of the other kindergartens I wasn't able to get into. And they put me on the waiting list for Massey when my dad was working to continue with his postgraduate studies in Vier. So I went to a kindergarten that was not too far from my house, and I did not last longer than a week. And reason being was the kids obviously treated me differently. They've never seen anyone with dark skin before and curly hair. And the teachers weren't doing anything about it. So my parents were like, the best thing for me to do, like for us to do for our child, is to take her out of that environment. So I became a couch potato. I was watching all of the shows on TV. But, you know, like for someone who is 2.5, no more than 3, for that to be, you know, their experience, to not, you know, my parents, they really were trying to find me somewhere where I can stay safe. Well, my mum was busy with other things, my dad busy with work, and ultimately having to take me out because of that is quite heartbreaking. Luckily, I was accepted into a different kindergarten much later on, and my experience was a lot better. But to hear that for someone as young as 2, 2.5 is quite sad. My experience with primary school was also really tough. I was very much, there was only one other Māori kid and the rest of the school white. And I stood out, obviously, and it was hard. I noticed from a very young age that I was different from everyone else. So if you ask that question to other people, when did you notice, like, you know, the realities, or like how different you might be to other people, they might answer that question, you know, that they realize that much later on in life. But I was made to realize that quite young, the harsh realities of the world. I hated my skin. I hated the texture of my hair. I very much wanted to be like everyone else. I wanted to fit in, and I tried my best to hide, but I couldn't. So that battle of self-acceptance and being able to be proud of who I am and where I come from took me a long time. But when it finally hit, it really did. But as a young person growing up in a country or a city where you don't really see much of yourself, it's quite isolating, it's quite lonely.
That's really quite challenging. So thank you for sharing that, because I know that's a struggle, especially when you're so young. You know, if you think about young people, we have no agenda, no story, no history, but our story is dictated by the people around us, who are normally our parents or our guardians. So, you know, it's for you as a young person going into this environment here, it's not the story of the young people, it's the story of the young people that's been told by their generational upbringing, which is pretty sad. But it's just awesome that you had that awareness, but also quite sad that the awareness made you think that, oh, actually I was not meant to be here because of my skin color or my tone or whatever. And you know, the question is, you know, how many people out there feel that every single day for different reasons, you know, whether it's skin color, whether it's gender, whatever it is. But it's a question I think that society is going to ask itself and go, hey, yep, cool, we are all inclusive and all clear, but actually at the base root level, are we actually doing all those things? But I think, like you said before, the world has changed quite dramatically. And Thomas North specifically, I know we had Ali Muhammad here late last year, and he spoke about how amazing the community is right now, and it's changed, and the refugee community and the Afghan community and the community has changed. But it had to go through a long story to get to the stage there, and hopefully we don't repeat that. But you know, history is a pretty crazy place. So thank you for sharing that. And you know, I think Tana, you might want to add in here, you know, how it's been for you as a young Maori person navigating that journey as well.
Yeah, I think it was definitely an interesting, I guess, place to navigate. In primary school, I think I wasn't as aware of it because we did have quite a diverse primary school. But I think as I went further into my education, and probably particularly in high school, as I started to go in more of an academic light and not have many other Māori students in the academic classes, it did feel like these two realities of where do I fit in and where do I transverse. But I think also trying to do so that everyone was treated equally. And I think, you know, obviously there's other bigger issues in terms of education in itself, but I think, you know, having that realization that, you know, like when I would play sports, I would be with different types of people, and then when I was in the classroom, I was with different types of people, and how you navigate that and how you're aware of it. And I think, yeah, I think the biggest part to start off with is just being aware of it, and then it's how you create those relationships in the different spaces so that it is respectful of everyone's upbringing. But I think also, you know, throughout intermediate and high school, I think there's much more awareness around there are different people from different backgrounds now. You know, I think in primary school, you're not so aware of it because you're just not aware of many things, to be honest. Just, you know, you're still developing yourself as a person, as an individual, and still trying to navigate what everything means. So yeah, I definitely think once you get to intermediate and high school, that's where the real impact comes. And, you know, even seeing some of the, now that I work in holiday program and after school care, I see there's much more, I guess, acceptance. And obviously there's always going to still be challenges in terms of children understanding and being aware of different cultures and different ethnicities that they're surrounded with. But I do think there is a better awareness and a better approach by the support systems around them as well.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, awareness precedes change, and as you become more aware, you start changing. And also, let's not also lie, we also have our own prejudices as well. You know, we have our own biases as well, you know, stories that we're told as well. You know, it's always good to say other people, but we have the same stories that are told. And, you know, I have stories that were told about, you know, people that are different skin color. That was my generational stuff. And, you know, you have to also navigate that and go, hey, wait a minute, it's not just us versus them. It's also me versus me as well. And, you know, that's another dialogue that you have to have with yourself, which is crazy awareness. And it's always easy to blame, but also something we look back and go, hey, what about me and what I'm seeing out there? Let's talk about high school in Palmy. When did you start to wear your hijab? Because faith is important to you. And when did that become a real part of your life and go, actually, wait, this is the way I want to live my life, and this is who I am as a person, and I'm proud of it.
No, very good question. I feel like each time you ask, each hijabi has their own hijab story. My parents were very good from a young age to instill that faith, the Islamic faith, into practice from a young age. So I had that desire and connection from young. I would say, though, a lot of the time, and people can relate to this in many different ways, we were just taught what to do because that is what to do, not so much the why, or trying to find the answer for yourself as to why this is important for me, not so much why it's important for, I don't know, for my parents, why it's so important for other people and whatever else, not so much like why me. I remember I first put it on and like wore it out in public, I think it was in year five, for a short while, and I loved it. I felt quite connected to my faith and to myself and to Allah, to God, through that time. But I remember again, that was when my self-confidence was wavering a little bit, and I did have questions, and I did have teachers pull me aside and being like, is this really your choice? Like, are you comfortable? And I was like, yeah, like I'm fine, but still they just weren't convinced. But after a while I took it off, and then I didn't put it on for a wee while, and I was really active. I was very sporty. I was running a lot. I was swimming. And with that, there was something that I had to consider as well. So back to the question, when did I start wearing it fully? I started wearing it when I was 14, so year nine. And I remember it was a conversation that my mum had, and she was braiding my hair the night before school was starting, and she brought up the idea of, you know, me wearing the hijab. And I think during that time as teenagers, we are very aware of our appearance and wanting to look good and appear ourselves nicely to others. And I was just like, if I wear a scarf around my head, like, you know, I'll be not hiding, but I won't be seen as, you know, I won't be seen as the same as others. And that was something that I wasn't too fond of at the time. But my mum kept talking, arguing back and forth. And then I told her, I was like, okay, I'll only wear the hijab if you let me wear that one scarf that you have. And that's the only way. And she said yes to it. And I took her scarf. But I noticed as well, I got the same questions as I did in year five, like, why are you wearing it? And that time I really struggled. I didn't know how to tell people other than like it's expected of me in my faith to cover myself. But I thought it was more important. Like, I had to ask myself, I'm like, why am I wearing this? And I had to do my research. That was the first time where I was like, I'm actually going to try and build my own connection with God without it going through my parents, or like actually trying to figure out the whys for everything else, not just because I have to. And it didn't take me long for me to realize why it was so important. And I fell in love with the idea, and I've been wearing it ever since. So that was my hijab story. It kind of started with my mom telling me to do it, and then later on, it didn't take me that much longer for me to fall in love with it. And I truly see it as a part of myself. It's like a body part. I can't leave the house without it. And I love that I am able to cover myself without being so worried about what other people are thinking, especially like in social media. And like, you know, your opinion of yourself can be adjusted or influenced by what is trendy and what everyone else is doing. But I think the confidence that you have with yourself and being able to not compare yourself to others, but be happy and content as to where you are and who you are as a person, I think is really, really important. So I think that definitely helped me in my journey of self-love and confidence, and not being too worried about what other people think and sticking to what you believe in and just backing yourself for that. So yeah.
I really like that story share, because you spoke about, you know, this year five when you first had, when you first put it on, and you know, a lot of people think, oh, it's just part of your life, but actually you didn't stop because, you know, you said no, wore it for a few days, wasn't the right at that time there for whatever reason. And then the second time when you did put it on, it wasn't, what I loved about it was the why. You know, a lot of us go through life, we just do things because we have to, you know, because our parents did it or grandparents did it or because others doing it. But it takes a lot of time to stop and think about why you're doing what you're doing, you know, whether it's good or bad. And you know, when you find out the why and if it resonates with you, then all good. Oh, you might go, actually this doesn't resonate with me, and that's all cool. And it's that self-awareness that you have to have, which then brings self-love and all the beautiful things in whatever decision is made. And forget that the decision was to wear the hijab, and that became part of you and has become part of you, which is cool. But you know, the story is awesome because it's not I have to wear it, it's I want to wear it. You know, and I think that's the big difference. A lot of life, you know, a lot of us do things because we have to do it, not because we want to do it, or we do it because of social pressure, social capital. As you said before, you know, social media is a crazy dictating tool at the moment, for good or for bad. And, you know, that can affect the way we look at things. So it's really beautiful. I love how you shared that there. So thank you for that there.
That's okay. Sorry. Yeah, sure. It hasn't been easy as well, I think, with the rise of Islamophobia, obviously. And like, I have been discriminated against. I've had people call me names. I've had people try to take off the scarf of my head as well. But those experiences have only just made me more like solidified, I guess, in my faith and my reason as to why I'm wearing it. So it hasn't been easy. I think, yeah, it's tough. It's tough putting yourself out there, especially like wearing the hijab is it's like a red target, being like, I am Muslim. You're telling the world that you are a Muslim and you represent the faith. And I think with how things have been, let's say, look in the past decade, it can be really hard to hold on to it. And they say you feel like you're holding on to like coal, but you know why you're wearing it, and you're sticking strong to it. So yeah, like you said, the why is really important.
I love that, because that was my next question, because you know it's awesome. My next question was basically, you know, you've spoken about seems very easy, but the world is not easy. The world is a crazy place, and the rhetoric around faith, around Islam, and you know, different faiths, but specifically Islam at the moment is just like, hey, it's not a positive story. So you know that Jenna, I love you brought that up, because you know people think, oh, it's pretty easy for you to wear hijab and be okay, but actually, hey, wait a minute, you know, it's not an easy story. It is. You know, it might have been every day you've got to fight these battles with people that don't understand. And sometimes, you know, if you question yourself, but if you don't have the strong why, then that you very it's quite easy just to go, no, this is way too hard, and just I'm just gonna not wear my hijab, or I'm not gonna practice my faith. But what you also said, I'm really, really hit home, was the fact that, you know, in some faiths, like in Islam and in Judaism, when you wear things that show your faith straight up, it's basically, hey, this is my faith. Whereas in some faith, you know, if we take speaking out of line here, but you know, some faith, you don't have to wear anything, and you can believe what it is, and nobody's going to know the way you feel or the way you think, because there's no outward gesture, outward approach. But so yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that bit there, because that's the truth. You know, that's the story that you and your family and your father and I guess other people that practice the faith that is in the media for. I'm going to do this here for negative reasons. It's beautiful for you to share that there. So thank you for that there, because it's real. It's a real story.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I guess you know, in New Zealand a few years ago, we had that really shameful and really horrible mosque attack. And you know, that's an attack on your faith. And maybe we segue. How did you feel at that point in time? Because this is your community, your people, but also in a country where you know it took us all by surprise and shock. Do you want to maybe chat about that if you would like to?
Yeah, goodness, thinking back to it, heavy. I think most of the Muslims, I think all of us at that time can remember 2019 March when we first heard about it, and just how we felt and the events that followed, and it was tough. I remember when I first heard about it, it was in biology last period at high school. And someone, we were doing our internal, and then someone said, there's a shooting, a mosque shooting in Christchurch. That's a sentence that you never thought you would ever hear. Like, that's bizarre. That can't be happening. And even we saw it on, like, the news articles on, I think, One News or whatever, were following it live, and we just had our laptops and we're following that. But it didn't look real. I went back home, and the first thing that I saw was my mum watching the TV, breaking news. And then that's when it hit. That's when it hit. And I, like, it all came down to me. Like, this actually did happen. And this is really happening. Yeah, that's a, like, it was disbelief, shock. And I think as a nation, we were all really taken aback. Like, how did this happen? How, you know, like, why did it happen? And I guess the way that the nation kind of came together was really heartwarming. I think especially for us, because we really were in shock. And that year, my last year of high school, I was a head prefect. I was head of communities. And I guess, again, with me being a proud, visible Muslim, I guess when stuff like this happened, well, not that it does happen often, but at the time, me having that role, they kind of put the roles of me just to lead the school through it. And I, at the time, was very happy to do it. I was like, I don't see anyone else who can do it more than myself, as, you know, this is my people, and I think I can do my best to represent all of that. But I was very much in autopilot mode that whole week. I was looking after people, especially the young girls, the young Muslim girls as well. And I really put my own feelings aside and focused on, okay, how can I look after the young ones? How can I also lead the school to, you know, respond in a most appropriate way? And that week it was just bang, 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 bang. And then Friday, because Friday for us is a blessed day, we went off to the mosque, the Masjid in Palmy, and we walked together as a group. There was like quite a few of us, and we heard the adhan, the call for prayer, and then that was when all the tears just came out. And the whole time, yeah, it was. We all hear. We all like remember that time very fresh in our minds. It was the way that the country kind of responded that we also do remember. But I remember there was a conversation, like the topic of how did we let this happen? And I feel like a lot of people who come from a minority group, especially as us Muslims, Islamophobia was on the rise. And like as people who are, you know, seen as different, we do get those, you know, discriminated comments or whatever else. So things do slide under the rug. It was only about time that something did happen that kind of woke us up and be like, hey, we actually do have a problem in this country where there is racism, there is discrimination. It's not in our face, but those who experience it really do. It's real. And I think that was the first time where the nation finally was able to address that. So I think for everyone involved, this whole country, it was a big moment in our history.
Yeah, it was a big one for a lot of reasons. You know, the first reason is how did this happen in New Zealand? But I really empathize and relate to the fact that you talk about being discriminated and, you know, racism in New Zealand. I always tell people, you know, in South Africa, for example, during the apartheid regime, my parents always tell me about my dad telling me about this. You just knew where you stood. I'm not saying it's correct, but it was. If you were a certain color, you can't do this. It was in your face, right? There was no subtle, it was just bang.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, in New Zealand, it's a little bit different. You know, we say we don't have racism, but it's the subtleness that is actually worse than the blatant. So, like, at least in when it's blatant, everybody just goes, this is it, and it's real, and mm-hmm. everyone knows it happens. But when it happens subtly and people refuse to accept it and say it doesn't happen, that to me is, as a person of color, I just think that's even worse. But that's just my own experience, my own journey. But thank you for sharing that there, because, you know, none of us can empathize what actually happened for a Muslim community unless you're in that community, that faith there. And everyone has their own story around that time there. Yeah, so I know it is a heavy topic, but thank you for bringing that there, because there were so many layers there. But I'm going to shift it to a lighter topic now, because we've gone a bit heavy. You mentioned something that I think is really, really beautiful, is, you know, you were head of community at school. And that has been something that has been as part of your thread, I guess, through all the time that I've known you, that community, you know, has been something that is, it could be just by chance, but, you know, you've been a community builder by being a subordinate in RA, then to being a lead at the Student Impact 2JO. When did you realize that this is actually, was there, I mean, this is a hard question, were you naturally drawn to building communities, or is it something that you just, because you were in the role, that it became something, hey, this is cool?
A very good question. I remember in year 12 when they were putting out applications for head prefects. There was a fire in me that really wanted to go for it, not for the title itself, but for the people. People are a huge passion of mine. And I think, and the power in the collective, I think, as well, is something that I really, truly do believe in. And having good leaders that are able to lead people to success or to realize, you know, realizing their potential and all of that. And I think with my experience growing up with discrimination and trying to fit in, but then also realizing that I'm just enough as I am and I don't need to change myself. And representation is matters as well. It inspires others. That, you know, to see people who look like them, who represent them in different ways, are able to achieve things as well. And growing up, I did not see that. And my school as well, my high school, a lot of the head prefects followed a very similar kind of characteristics or whatever else. So me going for a head prefect role was, like, again, I hadn't seen someone who looked like me to be one of those five, because at our school we had five different head prefects. So I guess there was, but honestly, my push and my desire was the people. Like, I want to be someone, I want us to move together and to achieve great things, and for people to feel empowered. And I remember the conversation as well when I did get it, and of course, head of community, and me representing many different, you know, minority communities, a lot of people did talk about how, of course, Salma got it. She represents the African community. She represents the Muslim community, the hijabi community. Like, she, like, the school would have looked at that and would have been like, yeah. And I didn't have to battle with that feelings and those, I guess, expectations of the people. And, the, like, obviously those words did get to me. And the self-doubt crept in as well. And I remember talking to the person who was in charge of choosing us, and they said that that was not, you know, what we were thinking about. It's who you are as a person and what you bring and what how you carry yourself. And you can tell when people are genuine, and you can tell when people are in it for, you know, the right reasons. But yes, community has been a big thing for me. And I think that year really pushed me and told me and reaffirmed me that I can actually do anything that I set my mind to. I think it really, I've always wanted to do it. 2019 provided that opportunity, and then I kind of went with it from there.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I like the fact that whoever was involved in that selection process spoke to you about it wasn't just a tick box exercise. And, you know, like you said, you can tell when people are just doing tick box exercise versus they go, actually, we believe in you as a human, as a person, and you bring the skills here, as opposed to, hey, we just, community sounds sense tick box, you know, because then you go straight away, why am I actually here? Am I actually here because you want me to be here, or am I here because I have to be? And it's the want and have to, same to, you know, that want and have to are two powerful words that come up over and over again in life if you think about it that way there. But hey, pretty awesome community people. And you know, when you navigated your study at the university, you got involved in some pretty awesome projects. Do you want to speak about that there? So, you know, one of the things that really stands out for me is your work with the Women in Health Network. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about how you got involved in that and why that became really, really powerful for you and something that you really believed in?
No, absolutely. Women in Health Network has already been established for many years in Auckland. And it was only a matter of time where we questioned, why doesn't Otago also have a woman in health? Because we also, you know, have a lot of programs that focus in health professionals and all of the sciences as well. So 2021, I think it was, or 2022 was when they first introduced Women in Health WIN. And I had a girl who was in the cohort above me in pharmacy who messaged me and said, hey, this is what's happening, and I think you should go for it, for specialty lead of pharmacy. So she was the whisper in my ear. I went for it and ended up getting the position as specialty lead for pharmacy. So WIN was, it's a community aimed to empower young women in health and STEM, to provide us that space to realize our potential and to flourish and to foster each other, which I think is really special and really needed at the time, especially when we find, you know, women in like health to be marginalized sometimes against. So it's a really special place to have been part of, and to start up. The specialty team was in charge of the mentoring as well, so getting people who are already in their health professional programs or already in their science degrees to help mentor and guide the young ones who are just starting their journeys. So that was also really special to just see the bonds being created through that, and also being able to provide events and get-togethers for the girls to network, because that's a huge part of that program as well, network community and just empowering each other through that. So that was 2022 was my year of being part of the exec, and then 2023 was I wanted to take a step back and actually be part of the program and applied as a mentor. So I enjoyed both perspectives through that. So yeah, it was big.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really, really, and it's really awesome because, you know, like you said before, it's not just about doing something for the sake of it. It's about building the community, and this community will have a legacy for, you know, as young wahine go through this program here, you know. It's really pretty awesome that you were not just part of the exec, but also a mentor, which are two different hats that you have to wear, two different experiences, which is really cool. And at the same time, you know, you and Tano were student leads at Unicrew. And what is that like for you, because you know when the reason I ask the question is because when you're working with women in health, it's very specific. It is, you know, it's you've got a circle and you're working that circle, you know. Whereas Unicrew is a whole different ballgame altogether. You're now working with the community that is so diverse and so awesome in different ways, and some not so awesome, but you know, that's humans. But also the amazing projects that you get involved with that organization. What is that? What is what made you go gravitate towards that there?
I think the Social Impact Studios provide such a special place at the university. It's always been a place that I've always looked forward to since my first year, and was able to find my home within, you know, the chaos of it all. So I've always loved the programs that Social Impact came up with and were able to implement, such as Unicrew and Silverline when Silverline was active, and really found my place and found some really cool like-minded people and people that challenged my thinking in many different ways. And I think I was able to grow and learn a lot from that space. So when, and with my work prior to that, like you said, Women in Health is very specific. I was also working as an RA for 2 years by the time 2022 came about. So my work was very much focused on like specific communities. And I really wanted to experience more and explore more what the university, I guess, can offer in social impact. Is one of those special places where it can move. It's not just focused to one particular group. I guess depending on what projects they have, it can cater towards so many different groups of people and bring them together, which I think is really special. And the work that Sian and Poppy do is absolutely amazing. I see them both as legends. And I had the privilege of working alongside them in 2023, as long as with Tane as well. And our team was such a diverse group of people. Like, how did they manage to get all of us to come into the same, you know, in the same room? But again, that's life, and that's the university. You know, there's such diversity in everywhere, and we learn a lot from each other, and we're able to make spaces and be able to get things going as well together, which is really special. And I guess with how the three of us came about, as well as our special girl Chrissy as well, with the transition buddy system as well, that was the three leaders, Chrissy, Tanya and myself, we kind of came from it from different points. We didn't start together. It wasn't an idea that we came up together. But I guess after talking to Sian individually, she saw that we had something in common and that the three of us can come together and be able to make something as cool as that program. So I think the way that I ended my university time with the Social Impact Studios was incredible. And I really, really loved it. I think it really felt like a home away from home with the people that were there and the things that they were doing and all of that. I was challenged in many different ways, but I guess that there's some beauty in that, the lessons to be learned from the anger.
Yeah, yeah, so it's so awesome. And I guess, Tanya, I guess I'll ask the same question, you know, because again, you were a subordinate RA, you had your little community that you were working with, and then same thing with Selma, you're a lead. What drew you to that? And the reason, before I would say that, what I want to talk about is the thread that some of you spoke about community, you spoke about challenges, which is pretty cool. And challenge comes in any space, but challenge also brings, like you said, at the end, their growth, which is, you know, it's hard. Growth is not easy. Growth comes with challenge.
I think for me, it's always been a passion of people and a passion of giving back. And I think I recognize that quite a young age, that like it doesn't take much to give back and yet you get so much from it. And I think probably part of that comes from seeing how much work my mum done, you know, like behind the scenes to take us to sport and get us in the community and give us opportunities to do things and always support us. And so I think, you know, creating that environment for other people coming through, and then in the university space, you know, Sian kind of asked the same question when I went in as a social lead, because I guess when I first started volunteering, it was never planned, like it, you know, like I'd just show up because I wanted to see what volunteering was about. And again, I thought it was such a cool thing to be able to give back. And you know, if I had free time, I was like, well, I wouldn't be doing anything else anyway, so I might as well go along. But you know, I think as I got through it, I started to realize there were certain areas that I was passionate about, but also other areas that I could help drive. And I think, you know, having that initiative and that willingness to provide opportunities for other people, you know, like this transition program, and just get more people into volunteering, you know, to just see what it's about. And I think also trying to change that narrative around as well, because I think as I started seeing other year groups come through, you know, there was a lot of conversations around people going into volunteering because older people were telling them that it would look good on your CV. And I thought that was the wrong message to be portraying around volunteering. You know, I think it should be out of a goodwill. And obviously there's, you know, there's always going to be a little bit of you trying to get something out of it in terms of an impact point of view. But I think, yeah, to say that it's just, you know, good to be recognized on your CV wasn't the right feel to it and wasn't the right way to be getting into volunteering in the first place. And I think, you know, maybe that is the first push to get more volunteers out there into the space. And maybe that's the draw point you need. But I think those who get into the volunteering space and see the true impact of those who come out realizing that actually it's not about being on the CV or, you know, getting me in a good position. It's really just about giving back because I have the time and I have the capacity. And I think, I guess, you know, students have that great ability to be able to do that because their time is so flexible and because they, you know, they have that freedom to be able to chip in other areas where as we get into our adult lives and, you know, have much more of a structured work schedule, it's much harder to, I guess, get into that space too.
Yeah, that's so true. And you know, it's kudos to the two of you, but also to Sion and Poppy for creating the space here. You know, it is a pretty special place. And I'm really proud. I mean, I'm really proud of being, when I get going to there, it's so unlike any other space that you go into, because it bucks the trend of the normality of a university space, which is really, really cool. If there's such a thing as a normality of a university space, but you know what I mean. But also I want to throw a kudos to the three of you, Satane, Selma, and to Christy, because the program that you guys had as an idea has taken foot and has been a really fantastic success. So you know, you weren't there to see how it all played out, but you have started something that's really cool. And you know, I saw Poppy yesterday and it's pretty cool, and we can do a bit of a think about how it all went. But idea to realization is amazing. So kudos to the three of you for putting all those documentation, those hours into getting there. So thank you so much for that there. It's not part of the podcast, but hey, it's a kudos to the three of you for the hard mahi that you've done that I have been lucky to see. Selma, we've been talking for almost an hour, which is cool. And, you know, we only touched an iceberg of your story. But if you don't mind, I'm just going to ask you a few more things because I think it's pretty cool. Let's fast forward. So you fast forward, you do your university career, you create some awesome communities, life is a challenge as well. What is it like for you now as a young wahine who is now in the health sector, but not just a young wahine, but also a person of color working in the health sector in a community pharmacy where you're going to see all sorts of people? What is it like for you? And also, not just about what it's like for you, but how do you feel having gone through that day and, you know, the day you graduate and you go, cool, I've actually done this despite all the hurdles that you've had through life. Do you want to talk through that and what that's like at the moment?
No, very good question. Where do I start? I guess I'll start back with graduation. That is a crazy moment, not only for myself, but for my family as well. I was not excited for me. I was just like, yep, I did that. Even though, like, I shouldn't invalidate all of the struggles and the challenges that I came across, because it was really hard to get to that stage. So I'm proud of myself for making it to that fast. But I remember on graduation day, I was just thinking about my family, and I was thinking about all the sacrifices, especially my parents being away from home. I was thinking about my family from Sudan as well. Currently, we're not living the best of times. And I did struggle with the idea with me, you know, finishing this, doing this, you know, massive achievement in my life. With, you know, and thinking about their current situation as well, but just seeing how happy they were for me, I was like, no, if I can't really celebrate this win for myself, I have to celebrate it for the people that I love and the people that sacrifice so much. So graduation for anyone is a huge milestone, and they should never overlook that at all, especially knowing their journey and knowing, you know, how tough it was, and, you know, embracing all the good things and the not so great things as well about that. And it was kind of like, you know, a nice way to say goodbye to undergraduate times, which is the most unique part of your life. Like, you're never going to have that time where, you know, you're with so many, you know, different groups of people that are kind of going through a very similar, I guess, like wavelength or a similar time period of their lives together at the same time. So that was really special, and I loved the way that it kind of ended with the graduation. And Otago does a very, very special job of celebrating their graduates. So then after graduation, the reality kind of hits you and you're like, damn, I'm just going to have to be a working woman or a working person from now on. Well, up until, you know, whatever else comes up. But I knew what my next chapter was going to be, which was internship. And I did take a bit of a break before going into it at the beginning of this year. And I think it's been a bit challenging with your own, I guess, confidence with, okay, I've got all of this theory and all of this from university, and then finding that theory doesn't quite match up with reality is also a bit of a shock to the system. Try to navigate through that while also trying to stay on top of assignments and, you know, expectations, and trying to present yourself in the best way. With my workplace, I am the only woman of color, but there's another, is one of the pharmacists, he is a person of color as well. He's from a different part of the world, but again, both, I think both him and I were able to relate in the struggle of, you know, being someone, you know, who visibly looks a bit different to others, even though we know our story, we know where we come from. But again, how that might be perceived by other people. And I think one thing that I have had to take on, whether that's a good thing or not so good thing, because of, you know, me being a Black hijabi, that not many people within, you know, the city see that often, I take on, you know, whatever their perceptions of my people might be, my actions and my words can change or influence in a way. So I think even some of the challenges that I have received, like slight discrimination, I think by the end of, like, I see it and I acknowledge it, but I don't take it on board because that's not me. That's not their perception and their judgment of what they see of me based on my appearance is not who I am. But I sometimes find with conversations that I have with people of the public that the way that they viewed me has changed based on the way that I've reacted and have conversed with them, which is not a responsibility that I think we should burden ourselves with. But unfortunately, with the way that the world is and the way that people are, it's something that I am very conscious of. So it has been a struggle being a person of color working in health. I think having to prove myself coming from a student to a young professional now is really weird. But again, it's, I see myself, I'm in the middle of the journey, and I'm trying to, like, just embrace those moments and try my best to move forward with those challenges, but not let them break me down, and learn from the lessons that I've got at the moment. So I acknowledge I've got a long way to go. I've only just started. But I think, again, like we said, that self-confidence and knowing yourself and knowing that you are capable, no matter what, I think I've had to practice that a lot, a lot of self-talk to keep going.
And that's so beautifully said, because, you know, there's so many, it's not just, if we break it right down, the first thing is you're a fresh grad. So that's a challenge right there. You know, fresh grad, like you said before, the theory to practice, that's like, well, that's pretty challenging. It's your first time working in a space like that there. And then you have the other layer of being a young female, because that comes with its own stereotypes, its own perspectives. Then a young female of color, home stereotypes, perspectives. And then a young female of color of a certain faith. So, you know, as you said, it's all these layers that come in through, and, you know, we can't control what other people think. And I love the way you said it there, but it's very easy for us as humans to take that on if we're not aware. You know, this happens to all of us. We're all human. You know, if someone says something, we'd like to think that we brush it off, And we do brush it up, but sometimes it just niggles at the back there. But you know, we're all humans, but it takes a lot of awareness to go, actually, I'm not really worried about that there. And that takes time and it is a challenge. And you know, as you said, it's early in your journey, but you know, the awareness, it's always about awareness, you know, awareness precedes change. But also the one thing that I have really enjoyed about this the story so far, both from you and Tana, is which is ridiculous. You know, at the start I said my learning from this year was 90% of life is showing up, and for both of you showed up in lots of ways, you know, from showing up to wearing a hijab, showing up to be a community leader, Tana from showing up to, you know, to be another leader with another community. If either of you hadn't showed up, none of this would have happened, right? For whatever reason, right? So it's a really, it's a crazy full circle moment that, you know, that, you know, 90% of life is showing up, and then whatever happens, happens. And I guess for us, every single day, showing up at work, showing up at the after school program, showing up with what I do, you don't show up, you won't know, you won't grow, you won't, you know, you won't see those things there. So it's really, really beautiful. Tony, any questions before we ask our powerful last question of Selma?
I think we've got through quite a lot. So yeah, I think the last question is, yeah, will be a good way to round it off.
Yeah, Selma, you've shared some amazing insights today, and I really appreciate it. But we're not gonna let you off quite easily just yet. As you know, our podcast is called Baskets of Knowledge, and we invite our guests every week to share a piece of knowledge to put into our basket for myself, for Tanya, for our listeners. And yeah, we invite you to share something to put into our kitty. This could be from any part of your life.
Well, I've watched, I've listened to your last your podcast from the past, and it is a big question to be asking someone, but also it's a privilege also that you are asking me this question. I've got two. Am I
Sure.
allowed to share two?
You can have two because it's public holiday.
Okay. There is this one audio from this Formula One driver named Daniel Ricciardo, some people might be familiar with. And it goes something along side of, don't quote me if I don't have a quote word for word, but it's like, enjoy the butterflies, enjoy the nerves, enjoy, you know, the process of, you know, making a name for yourself. And I think from that, reflecting back on my time as a young person in this world, the journey to getting to where you are, and not forgetting, like, to embrace the journey and to savor some of the moments from that, because you're never going to get that time back again. Thinking about my time at university, there were some really good times. There were some times that I never want to experience again, but again, I'm not grateful for those negative experiences as such, but I'm grateful for the lessons that I've learnt from that I now carry with me. Nothing in life is easy. Nothing in life that's worth fighting for is easy. Like you said, showing up is like such a huge first step. And just being able to prove to yourself that you are capable. So I think, yeah, embracing the journey and the moments that come with it, and knowing that it will add up to something great, it will be worth it, all of those struggles. And my next one would be, if you are unsure about something, you are allowed to take your time. I think some people might feel pressured to give an answer straight away. And who knows, you know, that answer might not be, you know, truthful to themselves, but they just feel that I have to give an answer right now. So allowing yourself some space, some time to think about whatever it may be. And with full clarity, and then being able to answer with your truth, I think is really important. I think in this very fast-paced world, we just feel rushed to complete things and to say things. But you're allowed to take a step back, and you're allowed to think about things before you commit yourself to anything, I think would be something else. So yeah, I'll leave you guys with that.
Those are two really beautiful pieces of knowledge there, and I love them both because they are applicable in every part of life, you know. Embracing the journey, you know, with its ups and downs. You know, as you said before, there's some parts of your life that you wish you didn't have to live, but by living through them, you've learned a lot. And if you didn't have that, they wouldn't make, you know. I remember reading something somewhere where someone asked a question of somebody who had gone through some horrific times, and they said, Would you have preferred none of things to have happened? They're like, no, because if they didn't happen, I wouldn't have learned about myself. I wouldn't have learned about that. So, you know, it's it's hard, you know, it's challenging when you go through those trying times, and you always wish you didn't have to go through that, but then it's what you take from there. Which, you know, I always talk about this book here. If you haven't read it, it's called The Man's Search for Meaning. I think that's a really beautiful book, which really talks about what you've just been saying right now. And the second half, your second learning was, it's beautiful. You know, we live in a world where we just have to rush. We think we have to rush and give an answer. And it goes back to something when I do my coaching, I always talk about the power of the pause. And you know, the pause can be a few seconds, or it can be a few weeks, it can be a few months. But there's no dictating when the pause is. But if you're unsure, just stopping, stepping back, and just embracing the pause and going, all right, cool, why? What is the answer that I want to give versus the answer that they want to hear? Two different things. So those are really beautiful shares right there. Thank you, Salma, for that there. It's been a real privilege having you on here today. There's a reason why I was chasing you on to be on, and you can see, and for our listeners, you can see why, because Salma's story is really beautiful. You know, the honesty and the truth and the rawness has been really, really well shared. So really appreciate it. Any last words, Salma, for us or Tane?
I just want to say, when you first asked me, I was like, why do you want to talk to me? I think a lot of that, what is it, imposter syndrome came to me. I was like, I don't think I have anything interesting to give, but thank you to both of you for providing this opportunity. And I think this whole podcast itself, like the essence of it, is really powerful and really beautiful as well, just to hear people's story, because everyone has a story as to where, you know, how they got to where they are. And the impact that you project have had on so many people's lives is incredible. I've heard about your name for so long, and I only had the privilege of meeting and working alongside you last year. But ever since I started university, I've heard this name, Prajesh. And everyone that has I've spoken to who knows you just says such amazing, beautiful things. So thank you for all the work that you do, and thank you both for writing the space for the podcast for so many, you know, people from different walks of life to be able to speak and connect to the listeners as well and hopefully learn from. So thank you. It's been awesome today.
No, thank you for those kind words. And you know, this doesn't happen without Tane. So thank you to Tane. So yeah, we can keep saying thank you all day. And we'll be here forever. But it's been a real privilege. To our listeners out there, hopefully you have enjoyed this podcast. If you haven't, please go back and listen again, because I promise you, you've missed out the beauty and the powerfulness of this podcast. Yeah. Till next time, just remember to keep safe, keep smiling, and the most important thing is don't forget to put something into your basket of knowledge. Till then, take care. Bye. Talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Baskets of Knowledge.
Yeah, we hope that you found something useful to put into your basket of knowledge. And as we said before, remember to put something little into your baskets of knowledge every week. And as always, feel free to like, comment, and share this podcast. Thanks, everybody. Bye.